You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.
Sarah Pinsker is the Hugo Nebula and Philip K. Dick Award-winning author of A Song for a New Day. We are satellites. Sooner or later, everything falls into the sea, lost places, and more than 60 works of short fiction. She's in a band called The Stocking Horses, and her new novel is Haunt Sweet Home. Thank you for joining me, Sarah.
Thank you so much for having me.
I read a few of the stories in Lost Places from a wonderful press, Small Beer Press, and I read your novel. And one of the things I thought was everything this author writes is a novel. It's a matter of the length. It's a matter of the style of storytelling. And I'd like you to comment. How do you know when something's going to be a short story or novel, or do you make any distinguishing between the two?
I tend to think that there are novel length ideas and there are short fiction length ideas, and it's a matter of the scaffolding, I guess. But I do like a story that meanders a bit. I like a story that lives in the space and takes up a little room, which I think your observation is a cool one, and not something I've really thought about before. But I think I like to write short stories that feel like there's a world going on around them, and I think that might result in a short story that feels like it could also be a novel. And I know that people do say, like I would love to see the novel length version of that. And two of my novels were actually short stories that were expanded. A Song for a New Day, the short story isn't in it, but there was a story before the novel that has the same character and sort of informed it for me. I think it's a fair observation. I like to think that I've ended the stories at a place where you can imagine more things happening to the characters, but that particular journey has been closed in a way that it feels like you can put it down.
Your short story, Where Oaken Hearts Do Gather, is a miracle of compact storytelling. And you managed to tell a very complete and haunting and beautiful story with a large cast in a very short space. And I think the way you achieve this by essentially turning the writing the novel as a Reddit thread is interesting. Talk about the influence of new media on writing traditional fiction.
I think there's a lot of fun to be had, and as a writer, I'm always looking for where the fun is, because you need things to keep you going. I like the challenge of how can a blank be a story, and how can a story be a blank? So I mean that might be how can a teacup be a story, or how can a Reddit thread be a story? Whatever the thing is, I try to figure out like what is the thing that would make it so that you had to tell the story that way, and the thing I arrived at, it wasn't so. It looks like a Reddit thread, but the thing I was actually thinking of even more was there's a lyrics website. I don't know if you've been on this. It's called Genius, where you can look up the lyrics of any song, and it's a little better put together than a lot of the ones that were out there through the last 20 years. Where first of all, a lot of them are full of viruses and adware and all kinds of stuff. So you would look up the lyrics to a song and you get 5,000 pop-ups. But Genius is nice. But Genius lets people annotate the songs and make guesses as to what different lines mean. And but they don't state them as guesses. They state them as fact. And so you get all these people saying, well, you know, how they say, this line is about blah, blah, blah. And you look at it and you say, no, it isn't. But so the compulsion to argue, I'm not a big argue on the internet person, but I sometimes look at those and I desperately want to argue. And I was looking up a traditional song that had been covered by the Grateful Dead, and someone had written, Garcia and Hunter wrote this verse about an acid trip. And I said, that verse is 400 years old. They did not. But it's stated right there as fact. And so I started thinking about what would happen if a bunch of people were commenting on a song, like on the lyrics of a song on a website that was all about the lyrics of the songs and sort of trying to forensically approach them. And some of them would be off base and some of them would be right. And some of them would be, you know, just trying to have a like talk about their dogs or whatever. I wanted it to recreate the experience of any web forum that we've ever seen. But I wanted it to justify itself. So the fact that they were there had to be plot relevant. And then the lyrics had to be plot relevant, which meant I had to write the song because I couldn't just take a traditional song. I had to write a fake traditional song. And then the fun was like giving it like assigning it a child ballad number. And you know, talking about it as if it fit into that conversation. So, new media, I think anything is fair game if you can find a way to make it so that it's not a gimmick. That, at least for me, that's how I usually approach stories in unusual formats.
And speaking of new media and unusual formats, your new novel, Haunt Sweet Home, on one hand, it reads almost like it's a pitch for a reality TV show, which I hope comes to life. But it also begins with an excerpt from the script. So talk about creating a novel based on a TV show that you made up.
Sure. So when in my novel We Are Satellites, I had a character who was in the hospital and watching like whatever was on the TV over his hospital bed, and I came up just like as a joke, I came up with this show that was half home improvement show and half paranormal show, where people had to fix up their new house by day and then sleep in it at night, but all the houses on the show were reputed to be haunted. And I thought, you know, this would actually be a really fun idea for a show. I wish I knew how to pitch a reality show, but I don't. And a friend of mine said, but you know how to write a novel. I'm like, oh, you're right. So I went off and I wrote this book. So most of it is straightforward. It's the, you know, the through plot is the story of a woman who gets her cousin gets her a job on the set of this show, and she has the job of, it turns out, the night crew production assistant. And a production assistant is already the person who does like everything no one else wants to do, and in this case that includes haunting the houses. Because, you know, for the ratings, they actually need people to be scared. And so they, you know, they amplify what's going on with the houses. And she's the one who has to climb through the crawl spaces and up onto the roof and whatever it takes to scare people. But then I also liked the idea of showing an episode. And how do you show an episode if you're writing a book? The script or the transcript is an obvious way to do that. And so I have the script of one episode that runs through the whole book, and allows you to see also how, you know, unscripted TV is in the end. Even if it's not scripted, it is manipulated and it's edited. So you get to see some stuff in the course of the book that as it happens, but then you also see the version that's edited for TV, how it actually looks to the audience, who, even though they're looking for a paranormal show and they want to see a haunting, are ultimately going to get the version that fits into the format of the TV show, which has if you've ever watched a paranormal show or a home improvement show, you know, they have very specific formats and a very specific way that everything goes down in the episode. So that's why there's script running through it. And I had fun writing the really smarmy host, and his really cheesy jokes and the introduction to the house and the exact way that they go through everything. I had fun scripting an unscripted show. That was a bonus for me.
You know, one of the things I really like about your work are the characters and the character voices. Mara in this book, and the character who's in the first story in Lost Places, let's see here. Oh, yeah. Two Truths and a Lie. They both have a wonderful kind of, you know, slightly beat down, lower middle class, suburban feel to them. And I love that milieu since I am part of it. And so I like to talk about choosing that milieu and creating these characters who are, you know, kind of, they're flawed, and we like them because they're so well told, but might not want to be friends with them.
Yeah. I think certainly not the character in Two Truths and a Lie. I'm not sure she would be a great friend. She lies a lot. But I think Mara's trying, but she's a little bit of a mess. And sometimes it's hard to be, you know, you want to be friends and support your friend who's a mess. And sometimes it can be tricky. I like writing people who are trying, you know, they're trying their best to figure themselves out. They're trying to figure out their place in the world. And often I think thematically in my work, the thing you often come, that I often come back to, and it's not a thing I do on purpose, but I think it's just one of the, I think we all have sort of themes that resonate with us. I say, as my guitars are actually resonating as I speak, which is a fascinating effect. I think that a lot of my characters are trying their best in a situation where things have gone weird. And I think that's what I do a lot, is I twist one little thing. So you know, it's our world, and it's characters who, yeah, you could see you went to school with, or you were friends with, or they're tending bar at the place that you like to stop at in the evening. Whatever it is, and then they tell you the story about the weird thing that happened to them, and they tell it as if it's a thing that happens, and whether that thing is, you know, the other day I was helping clean out a friend's house, and I found this cassette tape, like a VHS tape of an old children's show, and then he said, and I said, do you remember this show? And it turns out he remembered it. My friend remembered it, and it's a real show. And then it turned out I was on it, and you know, these weird things happen to them, and they sort of try to roll with it. And I think that's where I have a lot of fun with figuring characters out. It's just letting them figure out how to deal with the situation that they've been given.
Your new novel is called Haunt Sweet Home, and that immediately suggests a ghost story. And I find ghost stories really fascinating, because on one hand, I tend to not be a person who believes that ghosts are actually there, but I also think that they are there, in that we haunt ourselves. We are haunted by our mistakes, our regrets. We're haunted by the great things that happened to us just once, but never ever again, no matter how much we hope or try to make those circumstances come back. And so I think the haunting is a great way to get at character. And so I like to talk about creating characters who haunt themselves, because a character in Two Truths and a Lie, boy, that gal is really haunted. And so it is Mara, and they are haunted by themselves.
I agree 100%. I'm not even sure I could say it better than that. They are going through life and I honestly don't think I could say it better. You've hit the nail on the head. They are characters who are trying to figure out their lives, and their lives are not what they think they are necessarily, and they're trying to do the things they think are expected of them, and also, yeah, haunted by their own decisions, haunted by the people that they think that other people want them to be, haunted by not knowing entirely who they are and thinking that everyone else has themselves figured out. I think that's always an interesting thing too. Like, we always think, like, look at other people and we say, oh, now there's someone who has it together. And you know, if you actually talk to that person, they're probably also trying to figure things out and they think you've got it together more. So, and then you just amplify it a lot for fiction. But I agree with you on ghost stories. And I think that's a big thing about this particular book, is that there's a ghost and there's a paranormal TV show and all of that. But in the end, a lot of it is that Mara has to learn that she's the one haunting herself, and that there's a way to cope with that, and there are ways to sort of get beyond that, even if you recognize it, maybe.
And I think that's the virtue of a novel like this, and the real drawing reason to read it and come out feeling a little bit better about your own life is that it helps us understand that we are the authors of our own lives, and that, you know, we can rewrite them at any moment. And again, Two Truths and a Lie and this novel, I think, share that kind of DNA. Both of the characters in this and in Two Truths and a Lie are the younger siblings who have not quite made it out of the nest. And I'd like you to talk about that, writing about that, because you do so quite powerfully and I think sympathetically, so that even though the people themselves are somewhat difficult, the circumstances are very resonant, no matter where you are on the economic ladder.
Thank you. I'm an oldest sibling myself, and a person who got the instruction. It wasn't an instruction from my parents. There were things that I thought were the way you were supposed to do things. And I thought you're supposed to go off to college and then you get a job and you don't come back. And so I followed which I did not get from my parents. I just, like, it was a media. I don't know. I just thought that was the way things were done. And so that's what I did. I think that I, at the same time, you know, I know the places where I've been lucky in my life that I have been able to really follow. And follow your dream sounds cheesy, but like, I, when I graduated college, I said, and now I'm going to be a singer-songwriter, you know, and I went off and I did the thing I wanted to do. And when I started writing, I was able to say, this is what I'm going to do. And you can't just say that, you know, other people have to favor you with, buying the stories and, you know, agreeing to be your agent and agreeing to publish the novels. Like, all of those things have to happen, which involve writing a lot and getting good at your craft. But I'm aware of every place that I was lucky. And I think I like to interrogate those spaces And I like to say, I'm very good at looking at the what could have been. I'm saying that as a person, I'm not trying to put quality on my own writing, but I think that that's a thing that I'm attracted to is the what could have been in my own life and the awareness of the places where I have been lucky. And therefore, I think I write characters with sympathy who may not have been as lucky or may not have made the right choices or they made the right choices at the wrong time. You know, there's so many places where things just turn. And so that, yeah, I like to follow those and just follow characters. I mean, everyone is trying their best to be the hero of their own life. And I think just keeping that in mind and trying to give that grace to the characters as I write them. There's a cool point where they sort of tell me what they want. And I feel a little bit sort of, I don't want to say like a conduit because I'm still in control, but there's a point where I reach as I get to know a character where they start doing things that don't quite feel like they come from my brain. It's some combination of knowing this person so well and then, you know, just getting out of my own way. So if I've done that well, then I'm happy.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you said you realize that you are lucky. And I think it's important because the characters, you realize that your character, and you also suggest that your characters might not have been as lucky as you. And I think that that's a really important observation and to ground the characters and make them feel real. Also, family is very important. Plays a huge part in this book. She's a part of a pretty large family, and they're musical, and the kind of inciting incident here is she needs a job, and she gets a job through her cousin, who's the successful one in the family. And I love the way you create this character largely off screen. So talk about, you know, creating a major character who isn't in the book a lot, but it is in the book a lot.
So she's, you know, she's this character who feels out of place in her family, and she feels like everyone else has it together and she doesn't. And then the one who has it the most together is the golden child of the family, is this cousin of hers who went off and the family lore is that he went off and got the first job he auditioned for in New York and immediately became a success. And he was doing commercials the day that he should have been graduating from high school. And then he got this great job hosting this show and everything is perfect. And it's a myth, you know, he is playing a role. And even on that first, in the first chapter, when he shows up at the family home, he's driving a Rivian. And he's carrying this, one of those like giant bottles of wine and he has all these ridiculous things that he's done to make everyone think that everything is going very well for him, which you know it is going well for him, but he's just making everything larger than life. And we mostly like we see him there, and we see him through the episode where he's playing the role of the host, you know, and that's his job on screen, is to be this, you know, this very hospitable and friendly and charismatic guy. And he's doing all of that, but is that him, you know, or is that a role he's playing? And I wanted her to have that as something to look up to, which is unattainable because it's not the real him. It's the him that he's created in order to be a success. And so even when she, and I think we all, like, that's a huge thing in general right now, you know, you see all these TikTok influencers or Instagram influencers or whatever, and they are living these lives that are fake lives, and they're taking pictures that are fake pictures. You know, everything is photoshopped and angled and contrived and to make you believe in this life that they're living, and sell you that life so that you think that's what life is supposed to be, and that you can't live without your anti-aging beauty serum and your, you know, like all of those things. And it's all camera angles, and it's all, you know, it's all a lie to shore up a lifestyle that isn't actually a real lifestyle. So I thought that was an interesting thing for her to have this person in her family who is already setting a goal that's unattainable.
And this novel also offers a look at somebody beginning a new job in America. Never really a fun process, especially when you're starting out at the bottom. And, you know, you're outside. She's doubly outside because she's not in the union. Everybody else is in the union. Talk about creating just the uncomfortable circumstances of a new job, even if it's in a kind of a glamorous and interesting thing, as, you know, the house renovation show production assistant, which is Gopher.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you think of to, you know, Hollywood production as a glamorous thing, but there's a lot of really gritty jobs that go into it, and a lot of people who are working very hard to make the things that happen on the screen happen. So yeah, I wanted to give her the worst of the worst jobs. So she's not only in the production assistant job, she also discovers she's the night production assistant, and it means that when she gets to the tent and she signs her paperwork and she goes over to see where the cast is or the crew is, there's all the crew, and then there's this small group of people who are the night crew. So she's already in this outsider group, and then they all know each other, and they've known each other a long time. And so she's an outsider in that too. And she's in a job that's kind of seen as expendable. If she doesn't work out, the next person will step into it. And so, you know, they don't bother to get to know that person necessarily, because that person isn't necessarily going to stick around. And so she's, I wanted to put her at the edge of the production as well, the way that she felt like she was at the edge of her family, the way that she described like walking into classrooms and feeling like she didn't belong. She doesn't know how to belong, and she's looking for that. And the production, I mean, the night crew kind of functions as another example of family, I think. You know, she has the family she's grown up in, and they, you know, they're loving, but they're also a little tough loving, and they're a little, I think it's hard to be who she is among them. And then she gets to see another example of something somewhat like family, a close-knit working group, and try to figure out if she can belong to that. So yeah, I wanted her to be able to explore those things and see if there was a place for her. And I was having fun doing it with the production assistant because, you know, I haven't spent a lot of time. I've spent a little bit of time on TV sets, but not a whole lot. And so the easiest thing to do is make the person with the least knowledge your character, because she's learning on the job. And also her job is not technical. Her job is just do everything. So yeah, I cut that corner as well. If I had had like the lighting tech as the, or the gaffer or whatever as the person who I was following, I would have had to know a lot more.
At one point, you write early in the book, on the best of days, I walked around feeling like I was a puzzle piece in the wrong box, the one that everyone looks at once in a while, then tosses back and hopes that it will somehow sort itself out, which I think is a great way of describing Mara's, the way she feels in her family, the way she feels in her job, and also, you know, a nod towards what's called imposter syndrome. That idea of, you know, that you've, you even when you're successful, you feel like you're imposter. I worked with a lot of people in the tech business who had no computer or no college degree in computer science, but had learned to code just by learning the language. And these guys were just writing stellar code, doing really amazing stuff, but they all suffered, or many of them suffered from imposter syndrome. And that made me think, and this book makes me think, that imposter syndrome is just a way of saying, you know, I feel like a ghost, even though I'm apparently alive.
Yeah, I think that's another good observation. I think it's, imposter syndrome is a very real thing and a very, I think, a very easy feeling to access at some point in your life, even if you feel like you know what you're doing in your, you know, in your coding. Does that mean that you know what you're doing when you step into the workplace environment? And does that mean like you still feel like you might be really good at coding, but when you're in a room with a bunch of people who have PhDs in coding, like, do you still feel like an imposter? And I teach creative writing. Like, I teach a 400 level university creative writing class, and I have a bachelor's degree. I don't have a master's. I don't, you know, most people in my position have an MFA, you know, and then there's a whole lot of people who have terminal degrees also. They'll have PhDs in something similar. And I have none of the above, and I'm a good instructor. When people start, talking in academic or, you know, there's a feeling that I can get very easily, even though I know that I'm good, like my students like me and I get good ratings from the students and I think I'm good at what I do. There's still a moment where I feel very insecure when, you know, someone asks and actually it comes down to also like graduation when everyone puts on their regalia and they all have the colors of the go with their degrees and the places where they graduated from. And I don't have any of that. So I think that's an easy one to tap into. And that we all have some aspect of our life, probably where we feel some of that.
I love some of the supernatural setups of this book. Particularly, there's a scene in the orchard, which I think is really beautifully written, and also it just brings to mind the endless haunting appropriateness of one of the silliest and most inane experiences of my and many people's lives, which is when I was a kid watching Scooby-Doo. And you know, you might talk about Dracula and Frankenstein and Mary Wollstonecraft and feminism and science, but Scooby-Doo. Scooby-Doo is always there.
Yeah, let's talk Scooby-Doo. I mean, actually, now that you say that, you always find out in the Scooby-Doo episode that it was, you know, Old Man Winters or whatever behind the mask. Like they do the whole thing where they pull off the, you know, the monster head and there's the handyman who was trying to scare everyone away because he didn't want the house to be sold or whatever it was. And that was just real people and practical effects, you know, scaring people away from their haunted house. You are absolutely correct. Which is a lot of what Mara's job is. I don't think I name checked Scooby-Doo, but I think she might be a little young. I don't know if there's a new Scooby-Doo that's come around, but it's absolutely true that basically her job is to be the old man in the mask trying to scare those kids away. Except that it's a delicate line because she's not supposed to scare them away. She's just supposed to scare them enough that it makes good television. So she has to walk a delicate line. But it was a lot of fun trying to figure out what the practical effects could be for for the fact that this show is in its seventh season, so they've done a lot of things already, and they don't want to. So I had to think of the things they've done already in order to think of the things they would do in the seventh season. And she's the first, like, this is her first season on it, so it's new to her. It's not new to the crew. And then, you know, depending on how much the people who are on the show that week have seen it before, it might be new to them.
You know, we talked earlier about the excerpts of script in here, and they have sort of a wonderful kind of Rashomon effect. So that will, and it goes back and forth. Sometimes we see her doing the prep before we see the script, and sometimes we see the script before we see her doing the prep. And that gives us, like many novels that involve the supernatural, the structure and feel of a mystery and the compelling, you know, want to find out who done it, or in this case, what done it, or did what, or who do it. So talk about, you know, the influence of the mystery in a haunted house novel.
Oh, well, I love a good mystery, and I love a good haunted house, and I love playing with the tropes of both. And then we have the added thing here where we think we know who did it, is that we know that it's Mara. And so some of it is a whodunit. And then as it goes along and she loses a little bit of control, then the who starts coming in as well. And then, yeah, and... I think I love mysteries. I think they're delicious. And I love using elements of mysteries whenever I get a chance. The funny thing about the haunted house genre is I don't think this is a particularly scary, this is not the horrorist of horror books. It's not going to scare anyone who's in it for terror. I didn't write it to be that kind of book. So I like that we're talking about it as a mystery and as a Scooby-Doo haunted house, because most of the aspects of the haunting are, you know, have to do with the practical effects of it and have to do with all the things like you also did a great thing with starting with the questions about character, because to me, this is a book about a character who is haunting her own life, as you said, as much, which still doesn't explain some of the stuff that goes on, and it is supernatural also, but ultimately I think a lot of what I wanted to say has to do with the character rather than how much can I scare an audience. I wasn't really in it for that.
The fact that it's not scary, I think, is something of a plus. It's really delightful to read. And I think one of the things about the supernatural genre, the reason I love it so much, is because it's a great way to externalize a character's conflicts. When a character, you know, has some part of themselves they're uncomfortable with, you just put it outside as a monster. And then they look as, oh, well, you know, I really have an unfortunate relationship with this Frankenstein fellow. talk about using that. I think in this book too, the supernatural is superbly used. It's fun. I would say the rewards in this book are not so much on the scary side, but just on the fun side and on the character revelation side. So talk about orchestrating the supernatural in a way that where it doesn't become just the point of showing blood and gore and trying to figure out what horrible, awful scene can you concoct.
Right. I mean, part of that is ultimately that I'm a big wuss. And I like horror that scares me. I don't like gore, and I don't like not being able to sleep at night. So I know exactly I read a fair bit of horror, and I know who takes care of my heart. So as a writer, I try to be one of those writers who, even if I've decided, you know, I've got a science fiction mode, and I've got a realist mode, and I've got a fantasy mode. And when I step into the darker stuff, I want the other people to follow me. And so I just want to be, you know, known as a writer who will take care of your heart. And to me, part of that is also there's a thing that Buffy did really well. If you watched Buffy the Vampire Slayer, where there was humor in the, you know, it was a horror show, I'm putting in quotes. It was good at, you know, sometimes scaring you, but like not in the end of the day giving you nightmares. And it was good at undercutting some of the horror with humor. You had this cast who were funny and witty, and you know, and you had small moments also that allowed you to balance the humor and the serious stuff and the big themes and the little themes and the big monsters and the monsters that are actually us and all of the literalization of the monster and the figurative nature of what's going on. Game of Thrones also every once in a while hit that really nicely with I'm not going to spoil anything, even though the show's been over for a while, but the night before the big battle, when everyone is just sitting around the castle and you know, talking and laughing and drinking and not knowing if they're going to survive the next day, but like being very human for a moment. And I love in horror when characters get a chance to just be people rather than whatever archetype, you know, the horror that like sends five people into the woods and you know exactly what's going to happen to each one of them because of who they are. I just have no patience with that. So I want to write characters who have things going on and all think that they're the hero of the story and of their own story, not of this particular thing. And this isn't necessarily even the biggest thing that's going on in their lives. They're just trying to figure it all out. I think at the end of the day, I love writing something that's got a little bit of creepiness to it. I love a little bit of dread. And I don't want to give, I haven't found the story yet that I want to tell that would give people nightmares.
I might suggest that one, Two Truths and a Lie. It's pretty darn close to that story.
All right. People have told me that one has given them nightmares, but not it's not gory, at least.
No. It's just it captures a certain very creepy suburban vibe all too well. I've lived in those suburbs, so. But Dennis Etchison, like, if you're familiar with his work.
I think Science Facts also. I think science, the story at the end of Lost Places is called Science Facts, and that story has a whole bunch of fake scare stories told in the middle of it. There's a lot of other people telling stories to other people. And to me, I could get kind of creepy in those. And then pull it back a little to the story that's actually happening, which is a fun thing too. I like stories within stories.
You know, one of the things I liked about Mara, and I thought was, I guess, added to the sort of creep level of the novel, though it wasn't, you know, gory or scary, was her art and, you know, the connection between her and the tree she pulls down to turn into an art piece. Talk about using art to externalize our own inner self. It's telling, I think, that she creates a sculpture without a face.
Yeah, she... So the thing that inspired the sculpture aspect of the story is a piece in the American Visionary Art Museum in Baltimore, which is, I believe, called the Applewood figure. I want to call it the Applewood man, but I think it's the Applewood figure. And I think the name was probably put on it later in any case, because what it is a sanitarium patient dragged this giant piece of apple wood out of the woods back to the hospital and begged for a knife to work on it. And they, even though that wasn't allowed, they were given a knife, and they proceeded to create this self-portrait that's at the museum in the permanent collection. And it's one of my favorite pieces of art in the world. I go and I look at it every time I go to that museum. I can just stand in the room with that piece for hours. And it's the only piece that that artist ever created, according to the Wall Talker. And it has this concave chest because the artist had tuberculosis, and it's not detailed. It's got so much personality for a piece with very few real details. And I'm just so taken by that piece every time I go there. And I wanted to give a moment like that to Mara. I wanted to give her something that she felt compelled to turn into art. And I wanted to give her a chance, on a lark, to see herself in this piece and to see, to try to create something that was her own. So that was the idea behind that. If you don't know yourself, but you're like, I just wanted to give her a chance to try to externalize the her own self-image and everything that she was feeling in the way that great artists do.
One of the things is that I really thought was powerful about this story were the interactions that Mara has with Joe that are just uncomfortable, where Mara starts behaving badly and understands she's behaving and reacting badly to the other production assistant that she's working with named Joe. And she just, both of them just are somewhat unpleasant to one another. You think, wow, I want to hang with that person, even if it was me. And then, wait, I don't want to hang out with myself. talk about using discomfort in a story to get us closer to the characters who are just real people.
Yeah, it's an interesting line to tread, because you don't want people to hate the character so much that they can't bear to like read it anymore. You don't want to make them that uncomfortable. But you know, she gets irritated with herself a lot, and then she also is dealing with some jealousy issues, and Joe knows how to push her buttons, so that it gets a little bit testy between them because of that, because when you have someone who knows how to get a rise out of you and is willing to do that, and you already know that you're in a weird place, I think it's pretty easy to get to that point and to, so the trick is just not to make people hate your characters in those moments so much that they want to put it down.
You know, also too, there's a lovely scene with Mara and her family. She doesn't quite fit in. And there they all play music, and I'm looking at all those guitars behind you and thinking that's probably a family thing for you too. Talk about the power of music in a family.
Yeah, my family, when we get together, we have a family reunion every year, and we usually have one or two nights of music. There's usually a big dance party one night, and then one night where the guitars come out, and it's an interest. Like, music in a family is an interesting thing, because there's, like music in a band or music in a group of friends who play a lot, there's a a common language. There's a set pool of songs that you tend to draw from. New things come in very slowly, over a long period of time. You have to kind of wedge the new songs in there and hope that they take hold. My niece is 10, and she was she's a big Taylor Swift fan. So this year the challenge was trying to wedge a Taylor Swift song in there for her. But yeah, like there's the stuff that we've been playing my whole life, and then there's the stuff that it's not the same stuff as I play when I'm with my friends. It's not the same stuff. The stuff I play with my friends isn't the same as the stuff I play with my band. Which isn't the same as the stuff I play on stage when I'm doing a solo thing. There's just different choices you make. You bring different instruments in different situations, and you bring a different songbook, and you bring a different version of the canon that's in your head.
It to me, one of the things that's interesting, at one point I realized that music is a very high bandwidth communication conduit, in that in a couple of notes you can convey emotions and feelings and information that it would take you pages of prose to write, minutes just yakking or a long time in film. You can convey that very quickly in music. It's really, really powerful in that mode. So I like to talk about the relationship of music, writing for music, writing for prose, and how that works for you. Do you listen to music when you write?
I can't listen to music with lyrics when I write. I can do a little bit of, it can be a little bit of classical music or a little bit of like dissonant jazz. Anything that I start getting, paying attention to, doesn't work for me. So I can listen to music ahead of time especially if it's a musical piece that I'm writing, since a lot of my fiction has music in it, I can sort of get myself in the headspace by playing a bunch of music first, but then I have to turn it off. If I'm in a coffee shop, I don't care if there's music playing in the background, but I won't deliberately play music in the room where I'm writing. It takes up too much of my brain. I get distracted by it. I want to sing along, and I want to hear what that guitar is doing, or I want to hear what that oboe is doing. It doesn't, the type of music doesn't matter a whole lot. If it's good music, then there's probably something that catches my ear, which makes it the wrong thing for my writing.
The new novel by Sarah Pinsker is Haunt Sweet Home. Thank you for joining me, Sarah.
Oh, my pleasure. This was you had some great questions there. Thank you.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.